Can I begin this morning with a story about injustice? It's a story about a man who was falsely accused. He was hauled into court on trumped-up charges. You might even call it a political hit job, because the truth is it was the power brokers of the community that orchestrated all of this. The man got in trouble with them because he would just tell the truth. He would say it out loud, and that is threatening to people who maintain power by corruption and deception. And so because he was the sort of person who would say the truth out loud, they needed to get rid of him. So the prosecutor came, and he brought all of these witnesses. And they weren't very good witnesses, and the more the witnesses came, the more it became apparent to everybody in the courtroom, including the judge, that this man was innocent. He was clearly being falsely accused. The problem was that the prosecution had brought more than just bogus witnesses. They'd also brought a crowd. Outside of the courtroom was a boisterous mob, and they were so loud that everybody in the courtroom knew exactly what was going on outside of the courtroom. And so the man was eventually convicted. Not because of the evidence, but because that's what the mob outside demanded. And when it came time for sentencing, the judge handed down a sentence of capital punishment. Not because that punishment fit the crime that he was falsely accused of, and the judge knew he was innocent. He handed down the sentence because that's what the crowd demanded. Do you know the story?
No.
I got to stop with the rhetorical questions. You do know it. It's the story of Jesus. Betrayed by one of his own. Arrested by the temple guard. Amazing, isn't it? There was a time when the church had soldiers. Arrested by their church. Hauled in before the Sanhedrin, falsely accused. When Jesus finally did speak and he spoke truth about himself, well, that was enough. And the Jewish religious leaders took him to Pilate because they did not have the authority to kill him themselves. That was a privilege, if we can use that word, reserved for the state. Pilate didn't really want to have anything to do with this, but he was tasked to keep the peace. He knew what the consequences were for himself if he did not, and the Sanhedrin brought a mob, and they screamed, "Crucify him, crucify him." Why? This man has not done anything deserving death. We don't care. Crucify him. So they did. I believe in Jesus Christ, God's only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary, and he suffered under Pontius Pilate. He suffered. Well, of course he did, right? Because that's the story. And we've told that story again and again and again every year leading up to Easter. We tell that he suffered. And we know this, don't we? It's the story we were told. It's the story that we tell. And what I worry we miss in our familiarity is how strange of an idea it really is. Have you ever gotten so familiar with something you forget how strange it is? Think about this. As Christians, we go out and tell the world good news. God came down to be human. not to change his nature, but to join his nature with the human nature in order that God might suffer. Isn't that good news? We shouldn't be surprised if somebody who has no acquaintance with the gospel says, "Sounds like a strange God to me, doesn't sound very smart." Because isn't suffering the thing that humans try very hard to avoid most of the time? Why would a God want to come to suffer? Oh, for us and for our salvation, really? The very idea that the Messiah was going to suffer and that was actually the point, there was just no room for it in the conceptual framework of first century Judaism. Like, you could say the words and they could piece words together into ideas, but they didn't know what to do with the ideas. Jesus is telling his disciples over and over in the Gospels, this is how it's going to be. He does it in Mark chapter 8. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, not just one thing, many things, and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and on the third day rise again. And I love verse 32. And he said this plainly. Plainly. Now, in the Gospels, there are lots of things that Jesus says that, well, let's be honest, they're a little hard to understand. Some of them are a little cryptic. Some of them are purposefully a little vague. He speaks very often in parables. It's parabolic. He doesn't come straight at the point. He kind of comes at it. It's a curveball, is what it is. Jesus will say things sometimes. The Gospels tell us this. He says it in parable so that they wouldn't understand. And even in saying that, that needs an explanation. But this isn't that. This Jesus says very plainly, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected and die and rise again. Plain and simple. Now the Gospel of Luke says they just didn't get it. The meaning of what he was saying, it was hidden from them. But here in Mark, it tells it a little different. He says, after Jesus says this, Peter takes Jesus aside and the disciple begins rebuking the master. So at least on some level, Peter understood what the words meant together in series, but he's like, Jesus, you can't say things like that. The Messiah does not suffer. Except that he does. But this was one of the key things that people needed to be convinced of, especially the Jews. You might remember the end of Luke's gospel as we read it on Easter morning. You get two scenes, maybe three, depending on how you read it, but you get the disciples on the road to Emmaus. What does Jesus do? He shows up and they're like, oh man, this guy we thought who was going to be the Messiah, they killed him, so he must not be. Jesus says, how foolish and slow of heart are you? And he begins to unpack the scriptures to explain to them this very point that the Messiah had to suffer. And then they realize it's him, and he disappears. And so they run back to the disciples, and they're telling the disciples, we've seen Jesus, and there he is. And he explains to them, and he opens up the scriptures, and he opens up their minds to understand this one point, that the Messiah had to suffer. And this then, in the future, after Jesus is ascended, is kind of a key element of evangelizing the Jews. You see it in Acts chapter 17. This is a story about Paul. They came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead, saying, this Jesus, whom I proclaim to you, is the Christ. This was a really, really big deal in the first century. If you wanted a Jew to believe that Jesus was the Messiah, you had to get them to adjust that kind of framework and expectation that, yes, the Messiah had to suffer. And every time this happens, they always go back to the Old Testament. Jesus does it. Paul does it. And so then the question for a lot of Bible scholars is, and again, Luke does not do us the favor of telling us, the question is, if they reason from the Old Testament that the Messiah had to suffer, what passages did they use? There's a lot of options, but the one we all kind of agree on is Isaiah chapter 53. This is the fourth in a series of songs or poems about the servant of Yahweh, or what we sometimes call the suffering servant. I'll read you just a little bit of it. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that was led to the slaughter, like a sheep that is before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people? Now, that's not the whole poem, but I don't know about you, but I hear that, and that sounds an awful lot like suffering to me. So if we believe that the suffering servant is the Messiah, and I would argue that that was pretty broadly held belief in Judaism, how is it that they could not grasp that he had to suffer? It seems so plain in the text. And I'll be honest, I don't know why they didn't grasp it. I'm just telling you that's how it was. And this is actually very, very clear in what we call the Targums. The Targums. Do you know, right, by the time of Jesus, and actually for a couple hundred years before Jesus, most Jewish people did not speak Hebrew. Now, Hebrew was the language of the scriptures, and it was the language of the scribes and the priests and the religious elite, but it was no longer the language of the average person. Most people, including Jesus, spoke Aramaic. And so they had to translate the Hebrew into Aramaic so that they could use it in worship and in synagogue. And so what you end up with in the first century, time of Jesus, is what we call the Targum. The Targum is a paraphrase from Hebrew into Aramaic. Now, what do I mean by a paraphrase? There are a couple different ways you can translate scripture from one language to the next. One way is you try to go word for word, phrase for phrase, and maintain as much of the sentence structure as you can, moving from Hebrew to Aramaic. Another way is thought equivalency. It's what Eugene Peterson did in The Message. You read a Bible passage and you say, okay, what's the big idea here? And then you express that big idea in the best language you're translating into. That's what the Targum does. Now, what happens when you do a paraphrase translation is you end up with a lot of interpretive stuff that's not necessarily original to the text. And the Targum for Isaiah chapter 53 is very, very interesting. The poem in Hebrew begins this way: "Behold, my servant shall act wisely." But when they paraphrased that into Aramaic, they added something that wasn't there. It was an interpretive decision. In the Targum, it says, "Behold, my servant, comma, the Messiah, will act wisely." So there's really good evidence that in the first century, time of Jesus, most Jews believed that Isaiah chapter 53 was about the Messiah. Then why didn't they understand that he was going to suffer? Well, when you keep reading the rest of the Targum, it's incredible. The translator bends over backwards to avoid any insinuation that the suffering described is to be attributed to the Messiah. I got to be honest. He plays so fast and loose with the Hebrew. If I did it, you guys would be mad. You would accuse me of, like, perverting the text. And yet there it is. There's, at the same time, this insistence that this passage that speaks about suffering, it's about the Messiah, and yet we cannot bring ourselves to admit that the Messiah is going to suffer. It just doesn't work that way. Except it does. And this is one of the first distinctions that really separated Christians off from the Jews. We insisted that the Messiah came to suffer. That God himself came down to experience what it was to be human in its fullness. You do know, right, that there are forms of knowledge that we do not believe that God has. And that's not in contradiction when we say that God's omniscient, that he knows everything. He does. When we say God knows everything, what we mean is that he knows all about sin. He understands sin better than any person in this room. He understands its depths. He understands how truly evil it is. But you know, right, that God has no experiential knowledge of sin because God does not sin. He cannot. He doesn't have that sort of knowledge. So also, prior to the incarnation, we would say that God surely understood suffering. He understood how it worked more than any of us. But he did not have experiential knowledge of human suffering. Until the Word became flesh. And then he knew. He knew the whole range of it. He suffered in all the ways that humans suffer. The little ways, the big ways, because he had a real human life. So Jesus had growing pains. Because he was human, and that's part of the experience. Jesus had a time in his life, I imagine, where his body was growing faster than his brain could catch up with how it worked, and so he probably tripped over his big feet. They probably weren't as big as mine, but he tripped over them nonetheless. He was clumsy. Jesus went through the suffering that we call puberty. You know that, right? He wasn't exempt from that. That happened. Jesus had a time of his life where he was probably really awkward around girls. Jesus had a time in his life where, as a young man, he would have been very attracted to the opposite sex, as we all are. But he also had to make peace with the fact that his heavenly Father was calling him to walk a different path. He had to make peace with the fact that he would never know the love of a wife. And he would never know the joy of having offspring, of having his own children. You realize there's a loneliness in that. Jesus knew exactly what it was like to suffer loneliness. You realize, right, that Jesus had bad days. Jesus had days where I'm sure he was profoundly depressed, frustrated, discouraged, because that's part of the human experience. He suffered. He suffered under Pontius Pilate. It's curious to me, when we think about what the Apostles' Creed is, it's a very brief, very succinct summary of some core doctrines for the Christian faith, especially pertaining to the person and nature of God. And in that very brief statement of what it is we believe, only three human beings are named. Jesus, because he was fully human, his mother Mary, who gave birth to him as a virgin, kind of important to note. But then Pontius Pilate. Does that ever strike you as odd? It strikes me as a little odd because as I read the story, I've always thought of Pontius Pilate as kind of a tangential character. I mean, it's not saying he's unimportant, but he's not one of the main characters. He just kind of shows up at the end. He's the sort of character that seems like he didn't really want to be in the story in the first place. He wasn't looking to get involved. He just kind of got involved. And it's strange to me that he's the one we picked for the creed, right? I mean, we could have just as easily said he suffered under the Jewish leaders or he suffered under the Sanhedrin. And that might even be, you know, a little more to the point about the cause and the source of his suffering. But no, we went with Pontius Pilate. Why? Well, I'm going to give you three reasons. There may be more, but it's a sermon and all good things come in sets of three. So you get three today. The first reason I think we mentioned Pontius Pilate is, of all the characters in the gospel, he's probably the easiest one to date. Not to take out on a date, to put on the calendar, outside of biblical sources. Of all the characters in the story, there's probably going to be better records of his life. And I think what the creed is trying to do here is to drive home the point that this was a historical event. That what Christians hang their hat on is not a myth. Now, when we use the word myth, most of us in the room use it to mean a false story, but that's not how the ancients would have used it. When the ancients talked about myths, they would have told you that a myth is a story that tells us about the way things are. A myth is a story that explains everything in life and how all of it works. And if you brought up the point, well, yeah, but it never happened. It didn't happen in history. An ancient would look at you with a strange look like, that wasn't the point. And if we said, well, the myth isn't true, what we would mean is that it wasn't historical. But from the ancient perspective, they say, well, it is true if it tells you how life works. And of course, we believe that the gospel story does tell us how life works. How salvation works, how God comes to redeem not just us, but all of his creation. That's exactly what the story does. But it actually happened. That salvation does not enter into our experience through just the telling of some story. It doesn't come in through a myth. It comes in through history. And that, with Christianity, is a very important distinction. I think another reason that Pilate is highlighted is that, well, it highlights that Jesus suffered wrongly. Or he suffered innocently, I should say. That it was unjust suffering. Because in many ways, Pilate is... he's kind of the objective outsider, isn't he? It was the Jews that wanted to kill Jesus, and when they take him to Pilate, three times, Pilate says, I can't find anything wrong in this guy. When I evaluate him, I can't see any reason why we should execute him. He didn't want to do that. How bad is it when the judge who's sentencing you testifies to your innocence? He didn't just ignore his own conscience, by the way. He wasn't listening to his wife. His wife gets in on this in the Gospel of Matthew. Sends word to him, says, you should not have anything to do with this righteous man. That's her language. Don't have anything to do with this righteous man because I've suffered greatly today in a dream. On his account. Here's just a word of advice. If you find yourself in life ignoring your wife and your own conscience, you know you're in a bad place. You know you're in a bad place. But Pilate caves. He offers Jesus up to the mob because he wants to avoid a riot. And he has them bring him this basin. He says, I'm washing my hands of this. This isn't my problem. This is your problem. You want to kill him, you kill him. This isn't me. As if somehow that absolved him? No. So we mention Herod, I think, for the sake of history, for highlighting that Jesus suffered innocently. But it's also a reminder that Jesus' death was legal. This was a state-sanctioned execution. It was on the up and up. It's a reminder that because Jesus is a king of another kingdom, he poses a threat to those who hold power. And as followers of Jesus, we run the same risk. There's something about power, especially political power, that it wants to be absolute. It tends more and more to demand total allegiance, total obedience. And as Christians, we say, well, I'll pay your taxes, that's fine. But my first allegiance is to a different king and a kingdom that is not of this world. You do know at some point, if you live that out seriously enough, it will get you in trouble. That is the history of the church. Sooner or later, you give it time. He suffered under Pontius Pilate. Well, Pastor, that was a really nice talk about what it is we believe. What are we supposed to do with that? That's a good question. If we understand that at the heart of our story is the truth that God came down, became like us, to enter into our experience of suffering, and not just to go through it, but to redeem it, and that was the point all along, if we can remember how outrageous of an idea it is that the Messiah came to suffer, then it has to change our attitude towards suffering itself. I have observed in the church time and time again what I would consider a very unhealthy attitude about suffering. And it goes something like this. We believe that if something really bad happens in our life, a tragedy, a catastrophe, if we're going through suffering of whatever kind, be it acute or protracted, that what that must mean then is that God is angry at me. I've done something to offend the On High, because if God was pleased with me, he, out of love, would have delivered me out of this situation, or he wouldn't have let it happen in the first place. But that for whatever reason, I've done something wrong, and now I'm here, and God is mad. If you've ever carried that around, either consciously or unconsciously, can I try and dissuade you of that? Can we try and break those chains today? God is not angry at you. If you are suffering, or if you have suffered, or when you suffer, because it is inevitable, you must know God is not angry at you. Because God was not angry at his son. God entered into suffering out of love. He embraced it, and he redeemed it. He bought it back. There's nothing in suffering itself that's inherently good. You know this, right? And from a creation perspective, where we view the world the way God made it and the way it is now because of sin, there's nothing good in suffering unless God gets into it and brings something good out of it. We need to take the same perspective on suffering. Because if God entered into it, if He's redeemed it, then our suffering is actually a place where we find Him and get to know Him. This is what Luther says. He says, this is clear. He who does not know Christ does not know God hidden in suffering. It's for this reason that there are theologians who prefer works to suffering and glory to the cross, strength to weakness, wisdom to folly, and in general good to evil. These are whom the Apostle Paul calls the enemies of the cross of Christ, for they hate the cross and suffering, and they love works and their glory. But he goes on then to say this: God can only be found in suffering and the cross. So what do we do with it? The suffering. Because you're going to have it. Suffering is inevitable. We will experience this. And our first temptation, if you guys are anything like me, is to run from it. Yes? Oh, we want to avoid suffering. And we live in a culture that has given us all the best tools. If you want to distract yourself so you don't have to think about your pain, there are distractions unending. And if you're in a relationship that's painful, we live in an age where you can choose whatever relationships you want. Real relationships, virtual relationships, whatever you want. And when it gets painful, you just unplug and disconnect. And if it's the body that hurts, oh, we got drugs for that. Painkillers. You don't have to feel the pain. We are so, so good at running away from it. But can I tell you, that's not the Jesus way. That may be the way of the world, but that's not what Jesus did. He didn't run from it. He embraced it. So whatever suffering life brings your way, whatever cross it is yours to bear, embrace it. Embrace it. Take ownership of your suffering and claim it for yourself. Say, this is mine. Because only once you've claimed it can you then take it over and offer it up to God as sacrifice. Let me just say, this is the only worthwhile thing to do with our suffering and pain. Take it, claim it, give it to God, and say, God, I want to join my suffering to Christ's suffering. Whatever it is I have to go through, let it be joined to what He went through. And in it, let me find You and know You, and by Your power, redeem what it is that I'm going through, so that what seems to me to be death can become life, not just for me, but for others. See, many of us have forgotten that our suffering and our pain is sometimes the source of our greatest gift to the world. We have forgotten that sometimes our suffering and the place of our pain are the most fruitful places in our lives. But we don't know that because we're too busy running from it. Don't run from it. Embrace it. And then give it to God and find Him in it. Don't run from it. But don't wallow in it either. When I discover that I cannot outrun the pain of my life, that's my plan B. I wallow in it. I want you to like have the image in your mind of a pig rolling around in the mud. That's the right visual.